Yeah, I'm hopeful we'll be out of here by midnight tonight, which is 2 o'clock my time, so I really feel strongly that will happen. Actually, I think that we'll be out 4:09, I believe. When I flew into Medford last night about 10 o'clock, I went and down to the baggage claim area, went to, I believe I'm with Budget, rent-a-car place, and walked up to the counter, gave them the paperwork, and they said, "What kind of car do you want?" And they gave me a choice between a couple, and they wound up giving me a Nissan. I believe it's called a Nissan Rogue. I think it's spelled R-O-G something, something, something. And that's the first time I've ever heard of a Nissan Rogue or drove one. But, you know, from everything I can tell, this car works perfectly. I mean, it's got four wheels. Tires seem to be balanced. The car seems to be properly aligned. The car can run, well, I know it can run 65 miles an hour. I haven't tried 160 or whatever the speedometer says, but I feel fairly certain it could go faster than 65. And from everything I can tell, the pistons are moving up and down at just the right speed, at just the right time, that the spark plugs are igniting the fuel at just the right time, that just the right amount of oxygen is being allowed to flow into whatever area it flows into to allow everything to happen just the way it's supposed to be happening, that the steering wheel works perfectly, the power locks works perfectly, the windows work perfectly, that this car is designed, I think, as well and made as any car I've ever driven, any car I've ever seen. No one in this room would believe me if I showed them a picture of this car, and this is not the exact car that I'm driving, but it's one like this. If I told you all of those things about this amazing vehicle, and for me then to tell you that it did not come from a designer, that it did not come from an engineer, that no one made this thing, that it popped out of a pond near Medford, Oregon last night as I walked by the road. You know, no one in here would believe that. Everyone in here understands that this vehicle was made somewhere. You can even get Nissans in America today. I mean, they have Nissan manufacturing plant not far from where I used to live in Tennessee a few years ago. That design like this demands a designer. Some of you may be artists. We have an artist where I work. He illustrates our things. We kid him a lot and say he makes everything pretty. And we can give him an article that's in, you know, a boring piece of white paper, and he can turn it into a beautiful page that just makes people want to read it, it seems like. And he's an artist, and he paints. I can tell you for a fact that I've seen him paint, and I know that his paintings come from him who is a painter, and we all understand the truism and the truth that a design demands a designer, that a painting demands a painter, that a poem demands a poet, that a law demands a lawgiver, that design demands a designer, that functional, complex design demands a designer. I'm not talking about going down the road and looking at a rock and saying, that rock kind of looks like an old man bent over with small nose and big ears, okay? You know how sometimes you can walk next to a rock ledge and you can kind of see, it looks like the shape of a nose right there. Or you can look up in the clouds and think, I see a bunny rabbit up there in those clouds. I'm not talking about just happenstance, oh, here's a beautiful snowflake that, you know, is pretty and everything. I'm not talking about just happenstance stuff. I'm talking about functional, complex design that cannot be explained any other way than to saying it must be designed. And when you go outside and you look in this parking lot at all of those vehicles, and when you look at that Nissan Rogue or Rogu or Rogi that I'm driving, and if some of you drive that, you can tell me what the proper name is for it later, you know that thing is functional, it's complex, it has a design, there must have been a designer for that. And for the next few minutes we have together tonight, I want to point out some things in our universe and in our world that I believe are amazing, and they demand some kind of adequate explanation, somewhat similar to our law of cause and effect that says every material effect must have an adequate cause that comes before it. The design that we see in this universe has an amazing amount of design in it, and it demands a designer. When you look at our solar system, and you think about all the planets in our solar system, and how they go around the sun in perfect orbits, and how our planet Earth is the third planet from that sun, and then you have Mars, and how these planets are not crossing each other, and they're not running into each other. Our solar system, I believe, shows amazing design. And when you consider the fact that planet Earth is approximately, scientists tell us, 93 million miles away from the sun, did it happen just by accident? Well, if you believe that we are here, that planet Earth is here, because of non-intelligence and a Big Bang that occurred 14 to 15 to 18 billion years ago, then you would have to say, yeah, our planet's just there by accident. But how did our planet that has life on it get to be 93 million miles away from the sun? And scientists tell us that, well, if it were 10% closer to the sun, everything would burn up. It would not be possible to have life on Earth. And yet if we were 10% farther away from the sun, you would not be able to have life on Earth because it would be too cold. Well, did our planet just get here by accident? You know, in that, I believe it was in that same 1981 or 1982 Science Digest article that they discussed, that I mentioned in the last lecture, that they discussed how, on average, the Earth leaves a straight line as it makes its orbit around the sun, leaves a straight line 1/9 of an inch every 18 miles. Now, you know, if I could write on this wall over here, and I won't do that, okay? But if I could write on this wall, and I could just go, let's say, from here to here, and I had a pencil or a pen, I probably couldn't leave a straight line, only 1/9 of an inch, if I tried to. The sun, scientists tell us, cosmologists, astrophysicists, and others tell us that as it goes around the sun, it leaves a straight line 1/9 of an inch every 18 miles. Well, is that by accident? Well, those same scientists will tell us, if it left that straight line 1/8 of an inch every 18 miles instead of 1/9 of an inch, guess what? They say that we would be too close to the sun and that life could not exist on Earth as we know it. And yet, if it left that straight line 1/10 of an inch rather than 1/9 of an inch, life on Earth as we know it wouldn't exist because it would be too cold and it would eventually be too far away from the sun. That is the Earth. Well, was this just luck? Did the Earth get here by accident over billions of years just by happenstance? And what about our moon that's 240,000 miles away from us? Did it get where it is just simply by accident because of an explosion that occurred billions of years ago and through various natural processes without intelligence? Did it get to be 240,000 miles away from the Earth and cause the tides on the Earth that really are just right for life to exist? Scientists tell us that if the moon was about 20% closer to Earth, that the attraction would be so much that tidal waves would be covering most of the land on Earth right now. And yet they say if the moon were 20% closer, if the moon were 20% farther away, they say that you wouldn't have any tides and that the oceans would become like stagnant ponds and you wouldn't have the circulation of oxygen occurring. And I have been told that a great percentage, even perhaps 50% of the air that we breathe comes from the microorganisms in the ocean that is the oxygen which is circulated because of the tides going in and out, the ebb and flow of the tides. Now, did the sun get exactly where it is? Did the Earth get put exactly where it is? Did the moon get put exactly where it is? Do they orbit exactly the way that they orbit? The path that they orbit? Is all of that because of naturalistic evolutionary causes over millions of years? Or is it because there is a grand designer? I submit to you that there is amazing design in the universe, and that kind of design, just like that car that I'm driving this weekend, demands a designer. I fully believe that the earth, the moon, the sun, the planets, the 25 estimated sextillion stars and the observable universe, that all of that demands a designer. You know, evolutionist Paul Davies, and I want to quote a few evolutionists here, if you will hang with me for a few minutes. Evolutionist Paul Davies of Arizona State University said back in 2007 in a New Scientist magazine, he described the alleged, and he said 13.7 billion year old universe, which he said is the result of mindless, naturalistic, random processes. He called it uniquely hospitable, remarkable, and ordered in an intelligible way. Well, how could non-intelligence make a universe and a solar system remarkable, hospitable, and ordered in an intelligible way? I submit to you tonight that you can't have non-intelligence make something that is intelligent or that has a pattern that points back to intelligence. He admitted in this article to the many examples of, quote, uncanny, bio-friendly coincidences, and that's what you have to say it is if you don't believe, if you believe that all of this came about by happenstance over billions of years, and fine-tuned properties of the universe. He then wrote in this article, notice this quotation, he said, like baby bear's porridge in the story of Goldilocks, our universe seems just right for life. It looks, to use astronomer Fred Hoyle's dramatic description, as if a super intellect has been monkeying with physics. Here's an evolutionist in a very pro-evolutionary magazine saying, you know what? It looks like, to use the words of British astronomer Fred Hoyle, it looks like a super intellect has been monkeying around with physics. You know why it looks that way? Because it is that way. Because God invented physics. He invented the cosmos. He invented life. He created it, and He created the order that we see. I believe that is the logical progression when you go back to the fact that design demands a designer. He also went on to state in this article, if the universe came from any old rag bag of law, life would almost certainly be ruled out. Indeed, he said, changing the existing laws, like the law of gravity and other things, by even a scintilla could have lethal consequences. I was reading another article some months ago, and I don't have a slide of this, where basically the same thing was being said. You know, the idea was, why is gravity so perfect? You know, if gravity was changed just a smidgen, life as we know it on Earth could not exist. But you know, gravity's perfect on Earth for everything that takes place that does. Why is that the case? Because of luck? Because of time? Because of random processes? Because of non-intelligence? No, I believe it points back to an intelligent designer. Paul Davies, Dr. Davies, said a few years before his most recent New Scientist article that I was quoting from, he said, there is for me, and this is from a man who's an evolutionist, powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. Well, I would conclude that the reason why design and the impression of design is so overwhelming is because there is design. We're here. The universe is here. Earth is doing exactly what the Earth has been doing for millennia. And it's perfectly designed for life on Earth. Frank Tipler wrote in his book, The Physics of Immortality, back in 1994, he said, when I began my career as a cosmologist some 20 years ago, I was a convinced atheist. I never in my wildest dreams imagined that one day I would be writing a book purporting to show that the central claims of Judeo-Christian theology are in fact true, that these claims are straightforward deductions of the laws of physics as we now understand them. I have been forced into these conclusions by the inexorable logic of my own special branch of physics. And I quote this also as you go back to Richard Dawkins' statement that I quoted from about an hour ago in the first lecture. that if you meet somebody who claims not to believe in evolution, and he's talking about atheistic evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, insane, or wicked. I'm telling you that there are many thousands of learned men and women around the world who do not hold to the tenets of atheistic evolution because they understand the law of cause and effect, because they understand the law of biogenesis, because they understand the truism that design demands a designer. John O'Keefe of NASA wrote back in 1995, "We are, by astronomical standards, a pampered, cosseted, cherished group of creatures. If the universe had not been made with the most exacting precision, we could never have come into existence. It is my view that these circumstances indicate the universe was created for man to live in." Now listen, how is it that our astronomers, that those who work with NASA, and I have a cousin-in-law who works with them and has been for years now, she is a rocket scientist. She's a whole lot smarter than I am in a lot of ways. How is it that those who work there at NASA and those who are calculating all the figures, how is it that they can cause a spaceship to lift off down in Florida or over in Texas somewhere, and they can lift off and they can land on the moon, or they can go to a certain area, we'll just say the moon, when the Earth is orbiting around the sun, the moon is orbiting around the Earth, how is it that they are able to catch up with that moon? How are they able to land exactly where they want to land? How are they able to orbit the moon in the shuttle? Well, because they know exactly where the moon's going to be. They know exactly where the Earth is going to be in its orbit around the sun. So what does that mean? That means that there is a pattern, that there is a design, and we recognize it all the time, and we benefit from it. And my contention is that that design points to, demands, a designer. Richard Byrd wrote in 1938, years ago, he said, "If I had never seen a watch and should see one for the first time, I should be sure its hands were moving according to some plan and not at random. Nor does it seem any more reasonable for me to conceive that the precision and order of the universe is the product of blind chance. For those who seek it, there is an inexhaustible evidence for an all-pervading intelligence the human race, my intuition tells me, is not outside the cosmic process and is not an accident." And I agree wholeheartedly with, we're not an accident. There is design in the universe, and that just simply, what we've talked about for the last 15 minutes, simply has to do with the cosmos itself, which, by the way, the Bible writers say declares the glory of God. The psalmist said the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech or language, nor language, where their voice is not heard, their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. Paul said that for since the creation of the world, His, God's, invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead. I'm not quoting you these scriptures to say that this proves design. I'm quoting you these scriptures to say, I'm saying that to say there may be some or many here tonight who don't believe the Bible is the Word of God, and I don't want you to leave here and say, well, he tried to prove evolution wrong and God true by the Bible. That's not my point in using the scriptures, though I'm certainly not ashamed to do so. My point is, the Bible writer said, you should be able to look to the heavens above and know that they declare the glory of God. And you know what? Mankind, Paul says, has been acknowledging God since the creation of the world by looking at the world around them. The things that are made, human beings, we have been since time began, since humans have been on the earth. We have been able to have, we have had the opportunity, and we have acknowledged the existence of some kind of creator, though they may not have always understood who that creator was, based upon what they see in nature. You know, when you look at a laptop computer like the one on the screen behind me or the one that I have here, you may be a computer programmer, you may work at Dell, or you may work with Microsoft, I don't know, and you probably know a whole lot more than I do. Basically, I type on it and hope that the letters are not misspelled and those kinds of things. Surf the web some, do some research on the internet. I'm amazed constantly what you can do with computers. I'm amazed at how fast that they work and how well that they work and how I've taken one all over the country and used it time and time and time again. And you've seen a lot of movies that talk about computers, and maybe you've seen a movie that talks about how, you know, eventually we won't need many people on this earth and because computers are just taking over. You know what? Computers will never replace man. They will never replace people. They will never replace that 3 or 4 pound ball of matter that you have sitting inside of your skull. You know, looking at a computer like the one I have up here that's a few years old now, or the one you see on the screen behind me, you look at that and you see design, you know there is design, you know that that computer was not washed up on the shore and just somehow evolved from chemicals over millions of years. How is that you know that? Well, you know there's functional complex design here, and that functional complex design demands a designer. But you know what? The human brain far exceeds anything that a computer can do. British anthropologist and evolutionist Roger Lewin said just a few years ago, not even talking about the human brain here, but notice he says, the fastest computer clocks up a billion or so operations a second. This was back in 1992, okay? Which pales to insignificance beside the 100 billion operations that occur in the brain of a fly at rest. To say that the brain is a computer is a truism, because unquestionably what goes on in there is computation. But so far, no man-made computer matches the human brain. And my condition would be, well, even if you have a computer that could work better than my brain, then that's not hard for me to believe, okay? But even if that's the case, if you know that computer was designed, you ought to be able to know that your noggin was designed as well. Design demands a designer. Just a few years ago, there was a woman who was missing an arm. And there, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, she was a soldier, but I can't remember for sure about that particular incident of this story. Anyway, she was fitted with a bionic arm that reports said cost $4 million to build. I doubt she paid for it. I imagine she was kind of a guinea pig for this arm. Hey, how would it work? Let me tell you a little bit about this arm as it was reported in the USA Today back a couple of years ago, 3 years ago. They talked about how doctors were able to move nerves into Claudia Mitchell's chest, disconnect those nerves from actual muscles, and connect them to sensors in the bionic arm. So that 6 muscles in Mitchell's chest now move 6 motors in the bionic arm. With Mitchell's new arm, she can perform everyday tasks, such as folding a pair of pants without first stretching them and on a flat surface. And she can open up a spaghetti jar and hold it up at an angle and use a spoon to empty it out. Yet for all that can be done with advanced machinery, scientists still call this $4 million arm clumsy. Now, why do I bring this up? Well, simply because you and I both know, all of us understand, that if I had that $4 million arm with me tonight and I showed it to you, it would be amazingly complex function. As you can see on the screen behind me, it can perform a lot of different things. It obviously has design, and it obviously demands a designer. It took no telling how many brilliant men, no telling how many hours, with $4 million backing the project to design this and to make this. And yet, all of us in here tonight, as would Claudia Mitchell, would much rather prefer her own original arm than a bionic arm that was designed by men. Well, who designed our arms? A few years ago, Thomas B. Warren had a debate with Anthony Flew back more than 30 years ago. Thomas B. Warren was a Christian. He was a philosopher, received his PhD from Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. He debated the most well-known atheistic philosopher in the 1970s, Anthony Flew. Do some research on him if you would like. They debated, and in that debate, at least one, if not more than one occasion, Thomas B. Warren put up a a picture of a bionic hand, we'll say. It was not a real human hand. It was a robotic hand. And he asked Anthony Flew, was this designed? And Anthony Flew obviously said, yes, that was designed. And in that debate, he put up an illustration of a human hand and he said, was this designed? And he said, no. It just grew there. It just grew there. This just grew here by time, chance, random mutations, natural selection, selective adaptation, millions and millions of years, and it works perfectly. And we would much rather have it than a robotic hand or robotic arm. Now, I'm thankful that we have brilliant people today who can build those kinds of things and make those kinds of things. And if I lost my arm, I would certainly like to have maybe the option of trying to get one of those things. But I tell you what I'd much rather have is my original arm or hand that God designed. I believe that design demands a designer and that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. The next few minutes, I just want to talk about some amazing other designs that we see on earth. And this is what probably is the funnest part of this lecture to me. We live on a planet, not only with amazing human beings, and there are some amazing ones here tonight. And let me say one other thing just about humanity and about human beings. It is refreshing to see in Scripture how the Bible upholds humanity, tells us that we are like God. We're not gods, but God made us, Scripture says, in His image. We have something to live for. We came from God. I mean, Adam was created by God. The Bible calls him the Son of God in Luke chapter 3. We're made in the image of God. We did not evolve from rats. We did not evolve from frogs. We did not evolve from hogs or fish or fowl. The Bible says that we're special. And I certainly appreciate that. And I believe that we can have a greater understanding of humanity and our place in this world and understand how valuable we are because of who created us and not because of where we evolved from. But we share this planet not only with some amazing human beings, we also share this planet with some amazing animals that have some incredible design. You know, the tallest mammal on the earth is the giraffe. The male giraffe can reach heights of 18 feet. I believe the tallest giraffe ever that's been on record, I believe, was 20 feet tall in one of the zoos in England. I believe they named him George, and from his feet all the way up to the horns on his head were about 20 feet tall. The average giraffe goes to be about 18 feet tall. Their tails are about 8 feet long. From what I understand, they're not only the tallest mammals, but they have the longest tail of any mammal on earth. They have tongues. Well, let me just show you my next slide here. They have tongues that are something like 16 or 18 inches long. My family and I, we were at Wild Adventures in Valdosta, Georgia a few months ago, and we stopped and we got to see how big a tongue was of a giraffe. Giraffes can not only take a tongue and wrap it around some leaves, their prehensile tongue, and draw that back. Giraffes, when they go to get a drink of water, you know, you thought camels could go a long time without water and drink a lot of water. I read recently where giraffes can bend down and drink 10 gallons of water during one drink. Not one gulp, but at one drinking moment, 10 gallons of water, and then go longer than a camel without water. Giraffes are amazing animals. They look like clumsy creatures, but you know, if Usain Bolt, the fastest man in the world right now that we know about, if Usain Bolt lined up next to a giraffe, you know that the giraffe could outrun Usain Bolt? They have clocked them at 34 miles an hour. Amazing creatures. Obviously, their neck is one of the most amazing things about it. Even though the neck can be 6 feet long, it has the same number of neck vertebrae as we do. I believe 7. That's what most of us have, I think. They're just a lot longer, a lot bigger, and a lot heavier. They can weigh up to 600 pounds. They're amazing creatures. But that's not just what makes them amazing. Some of the amazing design in this creature is simply understanding the fact that this neck has a head on top of it that sits some 8 feet above its heart. So here's the neck of the giraffe, 8 feet higher than its heart. Do you realize how hard the heart of a giraffe has to pump in order to get blood 8 feet up to its brain? I understand that the giraffe has a heart that's about 2 feet long. Our heart's about this size, if I'm not mistaken. The size of a giraffe's heart is about 2 feet long, has thick walls, and can weigh up to about 20 pounds. The blood pressure of a giraffe is about 2 times more than any other mammal, land mammal on earth, I've read, and is about 3 times the blood pressure of us. So think about it. In order to get the blood up to the brain of a giraffe, it's got to pump it up 8 feet into the air, at least if it's about an 18-foot tall giraffe with an 8-foot span from its heart to its head. That's a lot of pressure. Have you ever spilled something or dropped something and had to bend down to pick it up? And then had to stay kind of in that bent over position very long and felt all that blood kind of rushing to your brain? A couple of weeks ago, I guess about a week ago, before I left town, my wife was getting some grapes out of the refrigerator. She dropped all the grapes on the floor and she was, you know, bending down like that. My wife is susceptible to headaches a lot more than I am, so I was immediately thinking, oh no, I hope this is not the onset of a migraine right here. And you know what it's like when you bend over, and then when you bend over, you come back up, and then what? Well, then you kind of have this rush, and maybe you're a little bit dizzy, especially if you've been bent over very long. It can affect our balance. It affects, you know, kind of how we feel for just a few minutes. But what if you had 3 times the blood pressure that you have, and your neck was 8 feet higher, and then all of a sudden 8 feet lower than your heart? A difference of about 16 feet from one moment to another moment. My question is, how is it that the head of the giraffe does not explode when he bends down and gets a drink of water for several seconds or even minutes at a time? How is it that it can go from pumping blood up 8 feet into the air? If it's pumping, it's pumping, it's pumping, it's pumping. Now what happens? It would seem that his brain would blow up from blood flow because the heart is pumping so hard. How does it stop? Why does it stop? How does he not explode? Well, it's because there's some amazing, happenstance, accidental valves that just happen to grow in this main artery from his heart to its brain. That when he bends down, it stops most, if not nearly all, of the blood flow to the brain as it bends down. And then right underneath the brain, there is a kind of network of veins. Some people just call it a sponge that still allows and keeps some of the blood in there during the time it's getting the drink. This is amazing design in one animal that we don't really talk about all that much. If you would like another picture of the giraffe, just go look at Don's tie. He's got a couple of giraffes on his tie tonight. Didn't correlate that with him or coordinate that with him, but it's a neat tie anyway. Giraffes are amazing animals. My question is, how did the giraffe evolve all these things just at the right time? You know, how is it that he developed the right size heart in order to push that much blood up that high? How is it that the first time he bent down, his head didn't blow up or that he didn't die? How is it that all of a sudden he had the valves there exactly when he needed them there? Who caused those? Who designed those? Who designed that little network of veins or the little sponge that keeps just the right amount of blood so that when he bends down, he's still able to get some blood to his brain? Who caused all of these things? Well, your choice is random mutations, non-intelligence, chance processes, millions of years caused that. Or there is a designer who made such a design. A few years ago, I came to learn about an animal called a cuttlefish. Cuttlefish live down in the ocean, and they're not fish at all. They're actually mollusks. They have a cuttle bone, and they're in the, you know, the squid, octopus family. Amazing little creatures. I mean, I've been told they have green, bluish blood, just like, you know, squid and octopus. They can squirt out black ink out of their bodies, and they have eyes like something out of a Batman movie. They have large tentacles that can shoot out of its mouth like birthday party blowers. You know those little things you blow at birthday parties and they flip out and flip back in? Amazing little creatures. In fact, these animals are so amazing that some within our defense department, I understand, have recently been studying them because of their amazing camouflage abilities. That people are looking to these animals to learn better how to develop new camouflage techniques. Well, what's so special about the cuttlefish? Well, number one, the cuttlefish are able to change the kind of the form of their flesh as they go up next to a barnacle or a particular rock or something. They can make their flesh all of a sudden look a little more, you might say, rocky-like. They can go up next to some seaweed and they will move their tentacles more like this to make them look more like seaweed. I was reading one report about cuttlefish recently where they had them in fish tanks or some kind of tanks, and they put horizontal lines on the fish tanks. And they put the cuttlefish in the fish tanks, and the cuttlefish tried to mimic the horizontal lines, and so they splayed their tentacles out this way. And then they put them in other tanks, and they put vertical lines on them, and then all of a sudden they were swimming around with their tentacles up this way. So they were trying to blend in with their environment. But probably the coolest thing about these creatures is that they can actually change the color of their bodies. That is, when they swim next to the seafloor, they can change their bodies, the color of the sand. When they swim next to seaweed, they may change them like the color of the seaweed. When they can change their colors to many different colors just by sending signals from their brain to their pigment sacs. Well, what gave them that ability? How did they have that kind of ability to perform such amazing? I mean, you know, if I could change into blue right now and just blend in with my suit or my coat, that'd be kind of neat. You know, if we could change green, if we could go, you know, out in our yard and just say, I want to be invisible and I want to be the color of this grass. Well, that'd be kind of funny, I guess, walking around like tall grass, but that's amazing. What had just happened by time and chance over millions of years? Why is it? Are you telling me that the brilliant men in our defense department who were studying these creatures, learning to make new state-of-the-art type camouflage, that they are brilliant men, they are trying to invent and design new types of camouflage, new types of equipment, new types of whatever they're trying to build, but that which they are mimicking, that which they are trying to imitate in some way, it just grew there. It just happened by time and chance over millions of years. I'm sorry, I don't buy that. You know, another amazing thing about the cuttlefish is that the same people who are studying these animals, who understand they can change the color of their skin, they can change the color of their bodies to all different types of colors, they believe that these animals are colorblind. And yet, they can change their bodies, the color of various things that they're trying to blend in with. Let me give you just one more example before we leave tonight. The bar-tailed godwit. Couldn't we go through some amazing birds tonight? I don't know how many of you are bird watchers. I've never been an official bird watcher, but I tell you what, the older I get, the more amazed I am at these little creatures. And they're not all little, I know. But I mean, when you go outside and you see a woodpecker banging his head against a tree and he doesn't knock himself out, that's amazing. A few years ago, I was at a church picnic and I was watching some kids play kickball. And I saw my son kick a ball and he kicked it a little ways and he was running to first base. And first base during this game was a tree. Okay? Well, he was running. He was about 7 years old at the time. He was running, and he wanted to see if he was going to make it safe or not. So he looked at the person who was going to throw the ball at him. And he kept running as fast as he could, and he slammed right into that tree. And I mean, you talk about hurting a noggin hurting a kid and a daddy who just ran over there and picked him up and ready to get him home. Well, God didn't design him with the ability to hit his head against a tree. Let me tell you, how in the world can a woodpecker bang his beak that's on his head 40 times in about a 3-second period? Woodpeckers are amazing. You know, I just heard recently by one doctor who said that we have learned, and again, this is something I've learned from doctors and scientists who have learned these things firsthand, that the woodpeckers close their eyes in between every peck, where they peck, close their eyes, open them to look to see where they're pecking, close them. They said that for a long time they didn't know why they closed their eyes, but they now believe that they closed their eyes because if they didn't, their eyeballs would pop out of their heads when they hit them against the tree. They have a sponge in between their beak and their skull and their face that absorb apparently a whole lot of the pecking action and the brunt of all of that pressure that would be going against their brain. Amazing creatures. I didn't mean to go so long about the woodpecker, but he's an amazing, amazing bird. The mallee fowl, the Australian bird that can stick his head into a 15-foot nest that it builds and know exactly what the temperature is supposed to be for the eggs that the male is watching for the female to keep them at the perfect temperature. How does it know what the temperature is supposed to be? How does it, its mother or father never taught them how to do this. How do they know to do it in the first place? How is it able to stick his tongue and his beak down in some brush and know exactly what the temperature is? You know, we've perfected the thermometer, but it was perfected and really designed and built and created over hundreds of years. And here's a bird that had it in its beak all the time. Well, it just happened to be there. And what about the bar-tailed godwit as we close? Here's a little bird that, one of which they tracked from New Zealand, and its migration up on the, I believe it's the North Korea-China border in that area, and then flew on to Alaska and then back to New Zealand. Now they tracked one bird, I believe they called it E7. A bird flew thousands of miles from New Zealand, to the China-North Korea border and stayed there for a few weeks. Then continued its trip on to Alaska. This bird only weighs about a pound, a little less than a pound. Now think about this for a minute. If you could design a robotic bird that weighed less than a pound, that could travel thousands of miles, that could go exactly where you wanted it to go, that never needed a recharge, never needed gasoline, never needed any of that, through this several thousand mile trip, you would be labeled a genius if you could make such a thing, probably receive all sorts of awards and accolades. The bar-tailed godwit that they tracked, once it got to Alaska and then left, they tracked it going over 7,000 miles. Average speed, average flight of this bird was about the same speed that a giraffe can run at full speed, 34 miles an hour. Traveling over 7,000 miles without stopping for food, without stopping for water, without stopping for rest. 7,000 miles from Alaska down to New Zealand. How is it able to do that? What amazing design there must be in the body of the bar-tailed godwit to cause that to happen. Where did that design come from? And not only that, you know, if you're anything like me, when you go from here to there and place to place, especially places you've never been, you need a map. Or you need to stop at 7-Eleven or some convenience store and get your husband out there to ask him, you know, where he's going. You need some direction. I've never been to Grants Pass, Oregon before. I am thankful for the good directions that Nathan and Don gave me about, you know, take exit 58, go down to 6th Street and do this and do that. Got some good direction. You know, no one ever told the bar-tailed godwit where to go. It didn't take that trip with his mom and dad and say, "Ooh, thanks for showing me the way." It just knew the way, went to China, went to New Zealand, or went to Alaska and back down to New Zealand. And get this, they tracked it and it went back to the same place where it started. The same place. How? Why? Well, over millions of years, hundreds of millions of years, you had animals that evolved from lower forms of animals that eventually, when you go back in time, evolved from non-life, that evolved from nothing. Or you have the fact that there is an infinite, eternal, uncreated, supernatural, spiritual, outside of nature, non-material being that created nature, created everything in nature, and created the design that we see all around us in the universe, in our galaxy, in our solar system, in the human body, in plants, and in animals. Thank you very much for your kind attention tonight. I will gladly stick around a while if you have some questions and comments and things. If you just hated what I had to say tonight, well, you're welcome to tell me. I've been told things like that before. That's fine. If you have questions, a lot of the things that I've discussed, they're in books that are out there. I don't know exactly how many that there are out there from Apologetics Press, but I know that there are some. We have a website called apologeticspress.org. Nearly everything that we write is on that website in electronic form, and so it's free in the electronic format. So I encourage you to visit our website. A lot of the questions that I'm asked, I just refer people to our website because they're already answered there in a very detailed way. We have several individuals who write for us, and I believe that they're very quality articles and quality materials. And I know there are other things that others have published that are also good that can be helpful in either your search for the truth or in assisting you to try to give good answers to people who may have answers or questions about God and creation and evolution. Again, thank you for your attention. Don, do you have anything else for us? We'll stand dismissed. Thank you very much.